A single phone call can change the course of a life. It can carry joyful news or warn of coming tragedy. In more mundane times, a telephone call can bring people together to share memories, laughs, and knowledge. And if you're a father whose newborn son has just been diagnosed with a rare form of brain cancer, well, a phone call can be a vital lifeline.
I mean, as people would say, this is probably the worst thing that could ever happen to you. It certainly felt like that. It was shocking and devastating. And so we started just doing research, and I would reach out to everyone who would take my call all over the country, and everyone would. It was amazing. I was shocked.
That's Mike Abel. He's a dad from New Jersey who had to face the unthinkable, a son diagnosed with a rare kind of brain cancer when he was just 18 months old. It's the sort of situation that no parent, no person wants to deal with. Fortunately, the technology to treat awful diseases like cancer have advanced in remarkable ways. Unfortunately, there are bad laws that mean patients can have a hard time accessing those treatments or even knowing that they exist. On one hand, modern medicine makes use of incredible cutting-edge technology. But on the other, public policy has forced the industry to remain stuck in an earlier technological age, before phones, before the internet, before Zoom, when a doctor had to be in the same room as a patient to provide treatment.
As parents of a child with cancer, you're already fighting an impossible journey. All you're doing is making it harder. And that's what I'll never be able to understand. You know, it's just, it's impossible.
I'm Eric Boehm, and you're listening to a Reason Magazine podcast series about how the free market wants to keep us healthy and happy, and how the government is making Americans poorer and sicker. And if you've been with us since the first season of Why We Can't Have Nice Things, then you might be getting a little bit worried right now. Because whenever we start off an episode talking about a baby, things don't always go well. We've talked about the baby formula shortages that left parents scrambling to feed their youngsters, and about babies that died because healthcare bureaucrats didn't think certain hospitals needed neonatal intensive care units. So yeah, I can feel your blood pressure rising already. Let me put you at ease. If there is such a thing as a feel-good story on a podcast called Why We Can't Have Nice Things, then today's episode is that. Put simply, June Abel didn't die when he was an infant with a terrible brain tumor. In fact, he's doing great. He's 13 years old. He just started the eighth grade, and he loves playing soccer, as I found out when I caught up with him and his dad, Mike, at a game earlier this year.
Very nice to meet you.
Hi.
Whole family affair here.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, that's great. That's wonderful. Tell us a little bit about what we're looking at.
This is the Montclair United 2010. You know, it's all by birth year for travel soccer.
Yeah.
And they're playing a Staten Island team. And so far, Montclair United is top of the league, undefeated, and they're down 1-0 at the moment. I'm not sure what minute we're in, but.
I'm gonna feel terrible if we jinx the perfect season the one day we come out here. Like, tell me where June's playing, what he's doing.
June's playing left back. So far, it looks like he's made some good passes.
He usually plays there?
He'll play left back or he'll play right back.
As I'm chatting with Mike and meeting the rest of June's family, his team is on the field battling back from an early deficit. They score just after halftime to tie the game, and then they take the lead.
Ooh. There you go. Wow. 2 goals in quick succession. Montclair is the second half team, it looks like.
While we're watching, I ask Mike what it's like seeing his son on the field a dozen years after June was diagnosed with a potentially deadly brain tumor.
It's the best. I try not to ever miss a game.
And I know it's been a while now. It's been, you know, 12 years since you went through some of the, you know, some of the stuff that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And the real difficulties, I guess, but that probably feels like the blink of an eye, I guess, right?
It does in some ways.
Or is it totally different? Is this person out here now running over that we're looking at?
Yeah, it is. It does feel like a different life.
Yeah.
Lifetime. But then certain things will will trigger it.
Yeah, I think when we talked before, you said it was like the worst thing that a parent could imagine.
Yeah.
The moment of that phone call and that diagnosis. To like, you know, having this, which is great save. Wow. This is probably not the thing you were thinking about, you know, in that moment.
No, no, you just, again, I think you shift at that point in time to, and this was advice I received early on, was like, don't even think ahead. Don't even think about the end of the day. Take things a day at a time, or even half a day at a time, or, and I embraced that, and that helped.
Mike and June's shared passion for soccer has given them more than a few memorable moments. They went to England together last year to see Arsenal, their favorite team, play a game. June has already taken some classes on the side to become a youth soccer ref, something that he might pursue further once his playing days are over, whenever that is.
He's definitely improved on being more physical, and he's got quite a knowledge of the game. I think it's more you just talk about his improvement, how far he's come.
A late goal from the Staten Island team meant that this game ended in a tie. But that's good enough to keep June's team undefeated for the season.
Hey, June, I'm Eric. Hi. How'd the game go?
We tied 3-3. They scored a last-minute goal.
Yeah, I saw that. It was like a tough angle, too.
Yeah.
Unlucky.
Yeah.
What do you like about soccer? What's your favorite thing about playing soccer?
It's just like, I don't know. I really like just like kicking the ball, I guess. It's really fun.
Playing with your teammates and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great sport. Mm-hmm. Nice to meet you, man.
Me too.
You really did a great job out there.
Thank you.
I think there's a metaphor in there. A soccer team doesn't succeed or fail because of the exploits of a single player. But of course, it helps to have a star on your team, someone that everybody else can look up to and expect to step up when the game is on the line. When June was diagnosed with cancer 12 years ago, Mike was looking for that person, and he found her.
And it's those conversations with specialists and doctors and people who know that are so important to inform your decision making. Because otherwise you were just lost.
You want to be able to pick up the phone and know that somebody's going to be on the other side.
Exactly. And you know, we've talked about is that community of doctors is so dedicated to helping parent or children and their families that they're willing to get on the phone. They're willing to help you out. And ultimately, they just care about saving kids.
Before June was diagnosed with cancer, he'd already learned to walk. But Mike says that he and his wife noticed something about their son wasn't quite right. Sometimes June would struggle to put his one leg down, like it was weak. A trip to the pediatrician and a follow-up appointment with a neurologist confirmed what was happening.
We do the MRI, and then everything happened. Basically, what happened is he had a tumor that was blocking all the cerebral spinal fluid, which was causing pressure on his brain, which was impacting his inability to walk. But he didn't have the normal symptoms that most brain tumor patients have. So he had to be rushed into surgery to create what's called a third ventriloscopy. It's a canal that helps the cerebral spinal fluid flow. And then 3 days later, he was doing a craniotomy to remove the tumor.
But the doctors couldn't remove the whole tumor because it was growing too close to a major vein. June needed to undergo radiation treatment, but you can't use regular radiation treatment that targets something as fragile as a toddler's brain. And that's how Mike eventually got connected with the star player on June's cancer treatment team.
My name's Shannon McDonald. I'm an associate professor at Harvard Medical School and a radiation oncologist at the Mass General Brigham. I treat mainly pediatric malignancies and rare sarcomas with a type of radiation called proton beam radiation.
Even a dozen years after she first treated June, Shannon is still deeply invested in his success.
I'm so happy you got to meet June and see him. I'm jealous. I want to see him play soccer. So that's very cool.
And she still remembers learning about his situation the first time.
Yeah, so his brain tumor was a rare type that is not one of the more common ones. There are a few experts in the country who have run clinical trials for this type of tumor. The other complicating factor is that his age, he was so young that you wouldn't be able to offer some of the more standard, more aggressive treatments that you could give to an older child, where you might give radiation to a larger volume. So his care was complex in many ways.
Okay, so I need to confess something here. When we decided to do this episode, I picked it because I read about June and Mike Abel's situation and, pulled at my heartstrings a bit. It's a great story, and it's got an important connection to policy, and it was perfect for our podcast. And all that's still true, and we're going to get back to that stuff. But first, I want to spend a few minutes talking a little more about Shannon's work, because interviewing her about it was one of the highlights of this whole experience for me. We spent a lot of time on this show complaining about what's wrong with American healthcare, but here's an awesome example of what the combination of knowledge and technology and wealth can do. My friends, she shoots brain cancer with bullets the size of subatomic particles. That is so freaking cool. It sounds like something out of science fiction, but it is very real.
Proton therapy, explain that to me like I'm a fifth grader. What are you doing when you're treating someone that way?
So regular radiation is widely available, usually multiple machines in every state in the U.S., and that type of radiation enters the body, but it needs to exit it too. So it treats more healthy tissue on the way out and sometimes on the way in. And for some malignancies, that's okay. And for some ages and disease sites, that's a great thing that's being delivered. But proton therapy has different physical properties where it enters and stops. So if you can imagine going into the head to treat a brain tumor and not having to give radiation that can cause damage to healthy tissues to brain tissue that is growing or developing in children, or high, needing to give it at high doses for adults, there's a great physical benefit to the type of treatment.
I think when we spoke the first time, I asked whether the metaphor of like a bullet going through a body was an appropriate one to use. Like there's no exit wound with the type of cancer treatment that you're doing, right?
Correct. And that's a great metaphor to use. And is actually used in some pictures where you show a beam going through the head and exiting the other side, or a beam coming in, treating the tumor and stopping. And even on the way in, depending on the depth of the tumor, it can deliver less radiation on the way in as well.
Now, just because of the highly specialized nature of Shannon's work, she ends up treating lots of patients who don't live in Massachusetts.
So we see a lot of specialized cases, rare diseases, and proton therapy is a modality of radiation that's not available in every state. So I do see a lot of out-of-state patients because of the rarity of the diseases that I treat and because of the modality being available in Massachusetts, but not being available state in every state in the U.S.
Why is that not more widely available? You mentioned that you treat a lot of out-of-state patients because they may not have access to it. Is there a reason why is this just it requires certain types of machines, or there aren't enough doctors doing this type of training?
Well, mainly it's cost. The capital cost of a large machine is on the order of $150 million to $300 million. So it's a huge capital cost. No, competitive engineering and time and experience has allowed vendors to make smaller machines, but they're still on the order of 60 million to 100 million. So much more than a linear accelerator, which is a normal type of photon machine that might be 1.5 to 3 million. So it's a huge capital cost. The operational costs are greater, and the staff you need to support a proton therapy center, physicists, you know, radiation staff, engineering, and physicians have to be trained for that type of treatment. So there is also a lack of staffing for some of the machines.
Mike remembers the first time that he spoke with Shannon too, and particularly how she put him at ease, which was probably no easy task. I mean, keep in mind his perspective on this. He's asking someone he's never met before to shoot proton radiation into his son's brain.
At the time, there was only about 10 hospitals in the country doing it. There was one in New Jersey, but they were pretty new. But Mass General was the best and the most experienced. And that's where we got put in touch with Dr. McDonald. Had a few calls with her. Obviously, we were really scared. You know, the thought of radiating a child's brain and the possible impact over it. But she walked us through everything. And we ultimately decided to go up to Boston for treatment.
Those phone calls, the ones that made Mike feel comfortable with putting his 18-month-old son in Shannon's care, those phone calls might not happen today. And if they did, they might be illegal.
The this, I don't want to be dramatic, but it can be life and death. Ending a patient-physician relationship can be, you know, it can be very bad.
This is Caleb Trotter. He's an attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, and he's now representing Shannon and Mike in a federal lawsuit against the New Jersey State Board of Medical Examiners. The lawsuit is challenging a law in New Jersey that's similar to laws on the books in other states, too. It's a law that does not allow patients to conduct telehealth visits with doctors who are not licensed in their state. As a practical matter, Caleb says that means the Abel family can't have periodic follow-up appointments with Shannon, who is based in Boston and not licensed in New Jersey.
But for the Abel family, because now of these rules, that it is technically illegal for them to call Dr. McDonald to have a follow-up, say, hey, look at this scan, or just to have a conversation to see how things are going. It's illegal just to have a phone call. It's illegal to have a video call as well. There is a problem for the Ables, but they also understood that this is a problem for other people in their position, but also especially for people going forward who, if their child is for the first time diagnosed with something that's rare and they need a specialist, these rules now are going to make it much more difficult for them to go find that specialist in the first instance.
As a legal matter, Caleb says the state is violating doctors' and patients' First Amendment rights.
All it involves is the ability to consult with an out-of-state specialist up front to determine whether this specialist can treat you, whether it's appropriate for them to treat you, or just, hey, maybe you should stay where you are because that's where you're best served, or actually not me, maybe you should go see somebody else. That's all it is. It's a conversation about whether treatment would be right. And then if it is, that all happens in person in a state where the physician is licensed.
All of this probably sounds pretty similar to what happened with June Abel. His dad had multiple phone calls with a bunch of different doctors, including Shannon. And then the family briefly relocated to Massachusetts for the treatment, because, of course, it's not possible to do proton therapy via a Zoom call. Nowadays, New Jersey's rules might prevent that initial conversation from ever taking place. And they might also limit the ability to do follow-up appointments, which are essential for anyone who has had cancer and recovered.
Then you've got the follow-up piece, which is also a conversation just about the treatment that occurred, or as things have come up in the future, just to review to make sure things are still going all right. If there was a problem, that would again just be a conversation that would lead to in-person treatment again. So these are just conversations between physicians and patients or potential patients. There's no treatment going on, no real conduct, if you will. And because of that, our argument is that this is just speech. It is not actually the conduct of practicing medicine. Basically, just the issue is the speech or is it conduct? If it's speech, the First Amendment applies. If it's conduct, it doesn't. So we expect to have a fight over there, but we think it's more clearly on the side of speech than not.
Both Mike and Shannon agree that the ability to maintain that relationship between doctor and patient is critical to the sort of successful long-term recovery that June's been lucky enough to have. And they both worry about the potential costs of limiting those consultations for others.
But I think it's more so that initial consultation. I learned so much from talking to so many doctors across the country, and I still, you know, I had a friend in town whose son, had cancer, went through recently, and I put him in touch with a former fellow who specializes in that cancer out in Seattle. And he responded from vacation on a Sunday, you know, and got on the phone with him right away, you know. So it's just, I think it's the education and just having access to knowledge, you know, when you don't have the opportunity to cross state lines. And that's why I think it's so important. But of course, the follow-up was important. And again, always having a mind like Dr. McDonald, so important and so beneficial. And we're so grateful for it.
So how important is being able to do telemedicine, being able to do video calls like the one that we're doing right now as part of that follow-up process?
Yeah. So I think it's very important, and it's so easy to do, and it's great for continuity of care. It allows a patient to see the doctor that treated them. It again allows us, if they're on a clinical trial, to get information firsthand rather than trying to get it through a medical record or faxed or sent. And I think that that it's so easy now. We use Zoom in every aspect of our life, and we're not thinking about what state someone's in when we schedule a Zoom, you know, or can we do it or can we not do it? And medicine was no exception. You know, Zoom or video conferencing exploded during the pandemic. And I loved being able to see my patients and follow up that were out of state, and they loved it too. And while some of these patients will fly back, many of them become lost to follow up because they can't take the time off from work. They can't afford to travel. And so they don't end up coming back for care. And so, you know, sometimes there's an argument of is a telemedicine visit as good or better than an in-person visit? And that's different depending on what the goal of the visit is. But many times the question is a telemedicine visit better than no visit at all?
I also asked Shannon if she's worried that someone who might have been able to reach out to her for treatment might never get in touch because of these legal limitations on telehealth.
So it is a concern. I think there are probably many patients who never reach us. As I mentioned, this is sometimes patient-driven. The family or patient has to have the bandwidth and resources to figure out that they need care out of state, to seek out those consultations and to make it there before the treatment needs to be delivered. And for many patients, that's just an insurmountable barrier. So I think there are many patients that never reach us, and that's a very hard thing to measure or to get data for. Like, what doesn't happen, you can't measure.
I want to dwell on that last point for just a minute, because this is something that keeps coming up in the episodes that we've done this season in different ways. Back in the first episode, we covered how a lack of transparency in drug pricing means that consumers often get ripped off without really knowing why. In our two episodes about certificate of need laws, that dynamic popped up again. We talked about how it's difficult to change those laws because you don't see the hospitals and the clinics that don't get built or don't get expanded because of these anti-competitive regulations. And now this is somewhat similar. We don't know exactly who is being harmed by this rule that says you can't speak with a doctor in a different state over the phone or over Zoom.
Tomorrow, Dr. McDonald could get a phone call from somebody in New Jersey saying, hey, I was referred to you, I have this problem. And she has to make the decision right then of, well, do I set up this call for 2 days from now and break the law? Or do I say, okay, hold on, let me go get licensed in your state, which is going to take months if she, assuming she wanted to. And in the meantime, they're either going to have to wait for treatment.
Both Shannon and Caleb are careful to avoid saying whether Shannon has broken New Jersey's law, or for that matter, the laws of any other state that restricts telemedicine. But as Shannon points out, those laws can be directly at odds with a doctor's other obligations.
And I think, again, physicians are confused, and you know, our ethical obligations are in direct conflict with the law. And our hospital knows that, and they don't, it's hard for them to counsel us on what to do too. You know, you want to give the best care to your patient. Your ethical obligation is the right thing to do, but it's technically against the law and puts your license at risk. And in some states, it puts you at risk for criminal charges.
That's true in New Jersey, where a physician who cares for a patient in New Jersey without holding an active New Jersey medical license is guilty of a crime of the third degree, punishable by 3 to 5 years imprisonment and a fine of up to $15,000. Separately, the unlicensed practice of telemedicine and telehealth in New Jersey carries a civil penalty of $10,000 for a first offense and $20,000 for subsequent offenses. And it isn't just New Jersey. More than half the states in the country have clear barriers to across-state line telehealth, or lack a clear way for physicians to legally use telehealth to check in with patients in another state. That's according to a report published earlier this year by the Cicero Institute and the Reason Foundation, which, full disclosure, publishes this podcast. Particularly in the post-pandemic world, where remote work and Zoom meetings are a fact of life for so many Americans, it seems like these rules are forcing doctors to practice medicine like it's still, I don't know, 50 or 100 years ago.
And in the modern era, distance disappears over video or telephone, but we haven't updated these definitions. So state licensure laws require that the patient is in the state that you're licensed. So unless I get licenses in all states in the U.S., that patient would have to travel to me, see me in my state. So I do think that during the pandemic, I saw, you know, a, for instance, a patient family, pediatric brain tumor patient who was in California, had consultations with St. Jude, with Boston, with New York, and then made a decision to travel out and come to Boston for this type of treatment that wasn't available in their state. And that couldn't happen pre-pandemic or wouldn't happen. And but what a beautiful thing to be able to meet the team that's going to treat you, make a decision for your child. And a lot of times for any medical treatment, you get a diagnosis and you don't have months and months to research what type of treatment you need to have. You have, you know, a couple weeks or 4 weeks. So it was wonderful for patients to be able to explore options in the comfort of their own home and make a decision. Do they need to travel for care that's not available in their state? Or is the care in their state perfectly adequate and the same and they don't need to move at all? But then they can feel satisfied that they looked into every option for themselves or for their family member and feel good about the care they're getting at home.
Even though he's overseeing Pacific Legal Foundation's lawsuit in New Jersey and another one in California challenging a similar restriction on telehealth there, Caleb says that most states will have to have lawmakers change these rules. Unfortunately, anytime you bring the legislature into the picture, you've also got special interests who like things the way they are. In this case, it's the medical community in each state that doesn't want to allow more competition.
So by severing that relationship, there is no other option for that patient. They either then have to hop on a plane or no longer have that relationship and that the availability of those resources and expertise. And I don't think anyone wants that. For whatever reason, the bad aspects of this just have not gotten the attention they need in the various state houses. I'll reserve for another time, thoughts on, industry protectionism and the boards of medicine themselves, but ultimately it's going to be the legislatures who need to change the laws anyway. Yeah. That's what's defining who can do telehealth.
In a Wall Street Journal op-ed published earlier this year, a couple of researchers, including a Harvard medical doctor, argued that the interstate telehealth rules remain restricted because state health boards worry about their ability to discipline physicians in other states, and also pointed out that those boards have exhibited a tendency to act as a cartel, protecting physicians in their state from competition rather than serving the needs of patients. The good news for state lawmakers is that there are a bunch of ways to ease these restrictions, even if full-fledged reform is just too much to handle. Some states have entered into reciprocity agreements that effectively allow doctors in neighboring states to get telehealth licenses or otherwise legally practice. That's how it works in Virginia, Maryland, and Washington, D.C., three places that share an overlapping metro area. Some states have gone even further by requiring only that out-of-state doctors notify their state medical board when they are doing telehealth there. And then there's also one outlier that I have to mention because it's just kind of weird. In Utah, there are almost no restrictions on telehealth by out-of-state doctors, as long as they are working pro bono. Okay, so on one hand, that would allow someone like Shannon to have those initial consultations with potential patients without breaking the law. Basically, as long as she's not billing them, she can do whatever she wants. On the other hand, though, why should the same activity be legal when it's offered for free and then become illegal when it's a paid service? That's just silly. Caleb's lawsuit against New Jersey's telemedicine rules is still ongoing. In April, the New Jersey Board of Medical Examiners asked for the case to be dismissed on the grounds that the rules are not violating the Commerce Clause or the First Amendment, among other things. A judge has yet to make a determination on that motion. But hey, I promise that this was a feel-good episode of Why We Can't Have Nice Things, so let me give you just one more amusing anecdote before we go. In 2018, Congress passed a bill that codified the longstanding practice of allowing out-of-state doctors to travel with sports teams and treat their players. So that means that when the New England Patriots traveled to New Jersey to play the New York Jets in September, the Patriots medical team was legally allowed to enter the state and to treat the broken bones and strained ligaments and concussions and any other medical situation that came about. But Shannon McDonald can't legally sit in her office in Boston and have a Zoom call with a cancer patient in New Jersey. And that right there, that's why we can't have nice things.
Yeah. Just the thought of cutting off that access, I mean, that was a lifeline for me in that process. And where I was an absolute mess every day until I started becoming informed and was able to make the decisions, and you set up a plan and then you start to relax a little bit.
Yeah, it does feel great. It's really amazing to see some of these kids grow up and live relatively normal lives, which is our goal for any child who's diagnosed with cancer. And again, you know, with the type of therapy we're offering all oncologists that treat kids, we're always trying to think about curing the tumor and also allowing these kids to grow up and have normal lives and a good quality of life, because some of the cancer treatments are so detrimental for future development that sometimes we cure a child, but they aren't able to play soccer or they can't do those things. And so, yes, it's extremely rewarding to have a child cured of cancer and to have a child cured of cancer and see them participating in normal activities and enjoying their life.
For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Special thanks to my guests on this week's episode, Dr. Shannon McDonald, who you heard right at the end there. In addition to literally curing cancer, she's also an associate professor at Harvard Medical School, and she still took the time to talk to us. Can you believe it? Of course, we also want to thank Mike Abel and June Abel and the rest of the Abel family for letting us tell their harrowing story, and we wish June all the best as he heads into eighth grade and beyond. And also thanks to Caleb Trotter, the attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. Read more about his work and PLF's other excellent work in defense of economic liberty at pacificlegal.org. We are rounding the bend and heading for the home stretch here on season two of Why We Can't Have Nice Things. Next week, in our final episode, we'll examine the war on drugs. The war on prescription drugs, that is. We'll bring you three short stories about how the government is making it more difficult for some everyday Americans to get the prescriptions they need to live healthy, successful lives. Join us next week for that one. This week's episode was written by Eric Boehm and produced by Hunt Beatty, fact-checking by Anthony Wallace. Our executive editor at Reason is Jim Epstein. Thanks for listening.